coming up on this week's A Lively Experiment. A blockbuster report saying the DOT knew years ago that the Washington Bridge was in trouble. What does the state have to say? And RIPTA will be looking for a new leader after its CEO resigns after a month of controversy.
A Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen-White, Jr. For over 30 years, A Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.
Joining us on the panel, Billy Hunt, chairman of the Libertarian Party of Rhode Island. Wayona Nelson-Davies, executive director of the Economic Progress Institute. And the Publix Radio political reporter, Ian Donis. Welcome to Lively. I'm Jim Hummel, and it is great to be back with you again this week. A midweek article by the Providence Journal's Patrick Anderson tied together information that has been coming out in bits and pieces over the past several months about the failure of the Washington Bridge. The conclusion? The state knew about the problems years ago, but did nothing. DOT Director Peter Alviti says a recommendation that his agency rejected, putting weight limits on the bridge a decade ago, is not a smoking gun, and that there were other reports contradicting the original finding. Billy, we actually have a majority East Bay panel this week. It was easy going coming in. It's not going to be for the next couple of years. Patrick's article, just your at first blush, what you thought about it?
Yeah, it was very in depth. It was very it's tough for the average person to kind of dig through the mountain of information that's provided by the DOT. On a given basis. So to have someone kind of wade through the details and spell it out about what was known when and what certain reports were saying. Alviti came out afterwards and said that there were contradicting reports. If that is so, I'd really like to know what those actual reports are and what those, issues were that kind of take away the truck weight limit that was recommended by the AECOM report back in 2012. Even if that was a minority report, you think in such a vital and important piece of infrastructure, they would give it a little bit of weight and maybe even consider it, and there'd be a little bit more discussion about putting that weight ban on the bridge itself.
Wayona?
Yeah, and for me, I think what was shocking was the lack of transparency, that we did know about this problem. You know, in December, in the press conferences we've had, there have been surprise about how bad the bridge was. But now we're learning, thanks to this great reporting, that in 2018, 2019, we realized the problem were worse. There were bids out to try to repair the bridge. And then there were contracts as well. So the Department of Transportation knew there was an issue with the bridge. It did not put safety before politics, in my opinion. And so just shocking that they're still standing down and saying they were surprised about how bad the bridge was, and we're learning that that is not true.
This is one of the best stories that's been done on the bridge debacle. Patrick has a particular interest in transportation, so the merger of this issue and politics is a sweet spot for him. Here's the thing. I mean, even if AECOM backtracked and reconsidered its original recommendation, which it did, according to Patrick's reporting, there was a significant chance of some kind of underlying issue with the bridge. Alviti can downplay it all he wants, but even if there was a 25 or 30% chance of some fundamental flaw underlying the bridge, shouldn't that have been a focus for DOT and the state well before the closure in December? And I think that's the question that a lot of Rhode Islanders are asking.
And in 2018, they put the contract out, right, for Cardi. There had to be, what was it, $50, $60, $70 million contract, I don't know exactly, that we've got problems with this bridge, we need to fix them. And that was I think there's a lot of questions surrounding that, because that was a project that started and then stopped because Gina Raimondo, quite frankly, was up for re-election.
Yeah, and Peter Alviti's messaging is that, with roadworks, they've upgraded so many bridges across the state. That's fine, but that doesn't go far enough, because it overlooks how 195 is a major thoroughfare travel by many, many Rhode Islanders and people from other states every day, and that given these indications of a possible problem, even if that was, even if some cold water was poured on the initial report, there should have been more scrutiny of what was going on all along.
And we're still waiting for the day of reckoning, aren't we?
We are. And I, you know.
Are you like, bring on the day
right,
of reckoning?
Because our families, you know, we're on that bridge. And now there's a lack of confidence that we even know what's happening with that bridge, the east in the bound. Is it really safe? We don't know yet. You know, we don't know because we're not getting transparency. We had the president of the United States on that bridge in 2022. That is a little bit concerning.
That was sobering. That's a great point that Yona makes about transparency, because according to Patrick Anderson's story, DOT declined to comment on the findings and the reports that were unearthed in part through open records requests by Patrick for his story. So, you know, now Alvidi is in damage control mode. But if, you know, they should have responded to the questions raised by Patrick's story at the time.
You also wonder politically, this article, I thought, gave Governor McKee a little bit of distance. Look, some of this was going on before he took over, but he continues to stand, you know, right next to Peter Alvidi, and you wonder how long that's going to be.
Well, that's the question, is that if you don't have the buck stop with the director, Alvidi himself, then it has to stop with the governor, and he has to take ultimate responsibility. At some point, somebody's, you know, if this was a private organization, somebody's head would roll, and there would be somebody that would be taking the responsibility for this. And as we wait for the day of reckoning to come, you know, that's really not happening. You know, another interesting part of this, which would kind of help navigate or communicate with the public possibility, would be Sabina Matos. I mean, she's been very silent on this type of issue. This is something that Lieutenant Governor, you know, when Dan McKee was Lieutenant Governor, he had a very big emphasis on small businesses and helping them out through the crisis in the process. Sabina Matos has been silent pretty much since her congressional campaign. This would be a great opportunity for her to step in and be able to, you know, help navigate through this process, communicate with the state themselves, help interface with these different departments and people that are working on this. And so far, there's been nothing from her office, which is kind of disappointing, in my opinion.
You know, the lawyers they hired are they were lawyers who have done cases before. And you got to think with what they've seen, they sniff something out. But you wonder if the state was signing off on these inspections and ultimately you're trying to go after a private company, that's going to be their first defense.
No, they are. But I think the defense has to end somewhere, right? We've gotten a lot of defensive responses from the administration and the Department of Transportation. Now we need to figure out what the solutions are. And again, I'm going to go back to we need to know what they knew and what they did and did not do. So I think now that day of reckoning is hold people responsible, but also make sure the solutions going forward are also justified. There are still safety concerns with the three lanes we're going to have on each side, right? Trucks are saying it's not going to be enough. I think they're about 10 feet, and people, experts are saying that is not a safe measurement for how much feet we need between each lanes. When I go there merging between lanes, I'm a little nervous driving on, you know, I-195. So we need to think about what the solutions really are.
Max Wistow, one of the lawyers hired by the state, is a real bulldog, and I'm sure his findings will prove provocative and interesting. But here's the thing. I mean, no one thinks Dan McKee or Peter Alvidi built the bridge or created it single-handedly the structural flaws that led to the closure of the westbound bridge. But the cover-up is worse than the crime, and what's telling about Patrick Anderson's story is how it contradicted the narrative and it contradicted what was said at a joint oversight.
Oh, we didn't know anything.
Right. And, you know, Rep. Joe Solomon from Warwick asked directly about whether there had been a load, a weight restriction recommended for the bridge, and the answer that he got was no, or was kind of fuzzed over. So this is, you know, the administration's response is important, too.
Last point on this, it's Friday. We're taping on a Friday morning. We referenced the three lanes now coming on westbound. I wonder how, it's a conjecture question, but we wonder how that's going to work. Narrower, 40 degrees. Honestly, if people would just stop texting, we'd all be a lot better off. But
yeah, no, I was pleasantly surprised with the eastbound changeover to three lanes, minus the hiccup when they first did the changeover. I think that's the biggest issue, is that when you hit any amount of traffic for amount of time, people have the instance to check their phone, start messing with other things in the car and not paying attention. And then as soon as there's an opening, people want to go from zero to 100. And then there's also, again, the frustration of this being an ongoing, everyday issue. It wears on people, and, you know, the traffic, you know, it just wears on people over time. So that's something that just, you know, hopefully we'll be able to get through once we get it up to three lanes and it'll limit that a little bit.
All right, next time we have you on, we'll have we'll do a little traffic study. Okay, I was off last week. A lot happened. CEO and president of RIPTA, Scott Avedisian, resigned. I think the writing was on the wall as information began to come out on a hit-and-run accident that, he's had. Ian, I know you covered this. He did a severance agreement with RIPTA. The larger question looking forward is who's going to run this agency? Scott Avedisian was a political appointee, as a lot have been in the past. Gina Raimondo appointed him. I don't know how much he really knew about transit. My question is, who are you going to get to come to an agency like RIPTA that's been so besieged with problems over the years?
That's a great question, and I think RIPTA has really been handicapped with in terms of trying to create a more robust supply of public transit across the state due to funding issues. But it's interesting to note how people who have criticized RIPTA in the past, like Senate President Dominic Ruggiero and the transit advocates who are most passionate in their advocacy, are kind of singing from the same hymnal now in saying that it should be a transit professional rather than a political appointee who is hired to lead RIPTA into the future. You know, perhaps there can be some coming together in the state in deciding whether I don't think RIPTA is going to be a huge profit center for the state, but transportation is important. It's always very ironic that in a small state like Rhode Island, it's such a struggle to have good public transit. So maybe there can be a meeting of the minds about the mission and adequate funding for RIPTA. But right now, that funding is kind of elusive.
Yeah, and for me, I don't know whether the timing is bad or good, right? Because looking for a CEO, as we've know from other departments' heads, you know, having vacancy, I'm a little concerned that that vacancy might last longer than we need it to. And then also with the challenges we have to have, it's facing a deficit right now. Drivers, you know, we don't have enough wages for drivers, so we have a driver shortage problem, and then we're threatening to cut services. So it's not an attractive job posting for anyone to come in. Any other to make that happen and make that happen quickly, the administration and legislative need to put some investments in RIPTA than they have in the last couple of years.
It's kind of a death spiral, though, because I understand they have a shortage of drivers and maybe a deficit, but if you start cutting routes, then what happens,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Billy?
Well, it's, yeah, $8 million deficit. And, I mean, the timing couldn't be worse, I think, for the governor itself. I mean, this is goes back to what we were talking about with Alviti and transparency on the DOT. A lot of people want to have a little bit more transparency on how this, you know, separation took place. I mean, if you or I were involved in a hit-and-run accident with the, you know, allegations of possibly being intoxicated, we'd be worried a lot more about, you know, keeping our job and negotiating the terms of our resignation with the $70,000 dollar kiss out the door. We'd be worried a lot more about the legal ramifications of it. And it just kind of goes to the same feeling that a lot of Rhode Islanders have, that there's this different class of people. There's a, you know, the ruling class or the governing class and everybody else. And, you know, for all the way from, you know, even we can talk from the president all the way down to, you know, the local police officer who's protected by the, you know, the Law Officer's Bill of Rights. You know, there just seems to be a different level of that people don't afford the same as the people who are ruling over them, and they don't like it. So it's just a bad timing for the governor in that sense that this all came out while the Washington Bridge stuff is going on.
It's been a big bone of contention for those in the private sector. I mean, when I left Channel 6, I had basically a box of stuff and a couple of stale donuts, you know, in the public sector. And I think they're trying to reform these contracts, but the fact that you can use get paid out $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for sick and unused vacation time. That is a tough swallow for taxpayers sometimes.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think Billy's right in describing a kind of inconsistency between the public and private sector on that. A lot of people would, if they leave a job and have unspent vacation time, if they're outside government, they're not going to get that money.
So. I didn't, honestly, this is going to sound funny. I didn't think it was an overly big payout.
No.
They could have had a really contentious, you know, look, there are allegations of DUI. None of that was proved. So it could have been a court fight. I think he left with 13 weeks and then whatever the unused was. So to me, it didn't seem like a lot.
Yeah, he didn't leave with a fight, and maybe because he's probably wants to get out of RIPTA now.
It's a great time to go.
So
right?
It may have been a good opportunity for him to leave this for, you know, the government to figure it out without him having to be there. But I think we also, again, if the administration and legislature use this as an opportunity to really talk about the problems challenges RIPTA have been facing, we have a transit master plan that we can be implementing, right? So having a new, fresh, bold perspective come in and talk about how can we expand services so we have more frequent, longer service hours, add more routes to what we have now, this could be an opportunity for us to have that world-class transit system we've been talking about for years.
You know, I think we need to have the discussion also about, people say RIPTA loses money, it's always in a deficit. Well, is it going to be a loss leader? Look at how much we spend on the convention center. Mm-hmm. It is, and that doesn't get talked about a lot. So are we going to chronically run a deficit and know this is a service you need to have in a community if you're going to have a vibrant community and people who don't want to get around in cars? Or are you going to say, no, it's not going to work in Rhode Island, you pull the plug? I don't think you're going to do it all together, but isn't that the philosophical discussion we need to have?
I believe 100%. I mean, as you know, there's no such thing as a free transit system, but if you know, it should be free for riders, for everyone. I think you know we spend so much money on stupid things and in the state, and you know a transit system would solve a lot of problems in the outside of the community. You know, look at how much money we wasted on the ferry system temporarily up into from Bristol to Providence, and you know the counts right now show that the buses traveling from the East Bay over the bridge have chronically low ridership, and that not a lot of people are taking advantage of them. So if we're going to have the system and we're going to invest in it, we should make it so it's more robust. We should probably combine it with some of this medical transport. We're spending a lot of money on that. That was really the point of contention prior to the pandemic. Combine those pools of resources together and focus on a unified transportation system, I think would be, you know, a better use of our funds, for sure.
All right. What has gotten lost in a lot of the Washington Bridge discussion and other things going on is there's a legislative session going on. Did you know that? They are on vacation this week, but when they come back, it's going to be the backstretch to the end. Usually in an election year, they try to get out by late June. Wayona, this is right in your wheelhouse. You have been keeping track of a lot of issues. What priority for EPI, and what are you looking at most?
Right. So we start with the budget. And so the first thing we're going to be looking at on April 26th, the revenue and caseload estimate conferences are going to be taking place. And why that is important is that is when we're going to find out whether we have a surplus in the revenue for our fiscal year 2024, whether we have lower caseload numbers. If we have that, that's a good thing. That means we have more money to spend on many services, including the bridge and public transportation. And then that will also show us whether we are closer to where we should be for fiscal 2025, again, to provide the Speaker and the House with the numbers they need to make clear decisions. So that's what we're going to be looking at. What's in the budget, and then what fiscal policies are going to be impacted by what those conferences revealed. So public transportation is a big ticket one. The governor proposed $10 million. RIPTA and advocates are asking for 18 just to close the deficit, and a lot more to address drivers' shortage issues as well as expand services. So that will be a big fiscal policy issue. We have the Medicaid issues as well. Medicare reimbursement rates are very low in the state of Rhode Island, and that's not attracting the medical providers. So we'll be looking to see whether we can expand those reimbursement rates when we find out what's in the budget. And there are so many other things. We talk about safety nets program. We personally advocate, along with Rhode Island Kids Count, about increasing our cash assistance program to make sure families can meet their basic needs in Rhode Island and also adjust for cost of living every year. And so those are a few fiscal policies we're looking at versus other policies that may not have a fiscal implication but are really important to communities.
The salad days seem to be over with the ARPA money running out. We were flush for years, and now they're already talking about out year. So it's the November and the May, they call it the Revenue Estimating Conference, and that's really going to determine, as Wayona said.
Right, absolutely. And the budget is the most important thing that is done by the legislature every year. Speaker Shikarchi has been saying that there's a vastly greater amount of requests for money than available money. But this Revenue Estimating Conference will shed light on whether there's more money to do some more things. I had Housing Secretary Stephan Pryor on my weekly interview show at the Public's Radio this week, and I asked him if he supports increasing a proposed housing bond from $100 million to $150 million as advocates request, and he was kind of cool to that idea. So, you know, some of these things will come down to how much money is available. One of the other top issues at play in the legislature is the Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. Critics say that inhibits effective discipline of police. Legislative leaders promised early action. That did sail through the Senate early with support from progressives, but the debate has kind of bogged down in the House, and advocates there are pushing for what they describe as more measures to raise accountability. And I think it's just a more contentious issue in a larger legislative body than like the House, than the Senate. But it's unclear where that will go from here.
Mm. Yeah, there's definitely some interesting things. Usually it comes together what the horse trading is going to be done at the end of the session when they're pulling these things out of the committee. Me and the Libertarians have our own bill that's in the committee, which is House Bill 7766 that we introduced. We're trying to get passed. That would change the requirements for a political party to become recognized by a state. So this is not a Libertarian bill. It'd be a nonpartisan bill. It'd be Green Party, Moderate Party, anyone. We want to do not only lower the threshold from 5% to 2% in the vote, but we also want to create a minor party status so that these minor parties can be brought into the fold and recognized prior to reaching that threshold. So there's not this chicken and the egg type situation where an organization has to organize and act like a party before they can actually be recognized by a party. So that's in committee right now and was heard, and we're looking to have success with that. And if not, we'll
have you gotten any sense from the leadership? I know.
Well, yeah,
it's kind of hard to tell.
We had preliminary meetings. They were happy. They overall in concept agreed with the concept. Secretary of State Greg Amore has been a huge help, and everybody in his office, including Rob Rock, who has done a great job with helping us formulate the legislation. And they've come out, obviously not officially endorsing it, but it's saying that it would help increase voter activism and people getting involved in the political process if they're not necessarily represented by the two major political parties that are there.
Two other issues, payday lending and paid leave, that are you very much have your eyes on.
Yeah, so we finally got a Senate vote on paid leave. And so it's out of the Senate. Now we're hoping for a committee vote in the House.
And that would do specifically how much?
So what it will do, it will increase the weeks from 6 to 12 weeks that families can take off. It will expand the family definition to include grandchildren and siblings and caregivers. And so it's a really exciting bill, and we're hoping the House will move on it. Payday lending reform, day of reckoning, I think, has come. We've been on this for 14 years. We've had a House committee hearing. We haven't had a House vote yet. We are getting word that the House will continue to support this as it did last year with the historic vote on the House floor. But we're hoping they'll do it earlier, so we're not waiting until the last week.
Come on, wait on it. 265% interest.
It's nothing, right?
Come on, lighten up. You're such a nitpicker.
Exactly,
you are.
I really am. So yeah, so we're hoping those two go through. Same day voter registration is another big one this year in an election year to decrease our voter registration requirement from 30 days to one day on the same day.
Safe storage bill, it passed kind of quickly in a little machination in the Senate committee. I wonder if that ultimately makes the final cut.
Yeah, I think we've seen a real change in the legislature with a bigger progressive caucus. And it used to be there was a very strong and uniquely Rhode Island cohort of pro-gun Democrats. That has changed where we've seen more action on bills like this. And I think there is considerable support for that. One note on payday lending. I've tracked this issue for a long time. I did an update a couple of years ago where top elected officials went to a high school in Pawtucket to support a fiscal education bill for young people. So on one hand, the state's promoting fiscal education for young people, which is great, while at the same time being an outlier in allowing the equivalent of such a high interest rate for payday lenders.
It's like taking the tobacco money and using it to fill the hole, right? Just briefly, anything else you're looking at the session this
No, I mean our focus has been our main bill. I think the Leibor, the bill is something that we're going to be keeping an eye on, and then obviously the Libertarians and the Second Amendment advocates will be taking a look at the gun storage bill. But yeah, it's been interesting. It's been a little bit of a quiet session. I know the Senate side has limited the number of bills that they would be accepting early on in the session. So us trying to get a companion bill on the Senate side was a little bit difficult later on in the year. But yeah, like I said, said, it always comes down to the end of session in June when those days get hot. So I'll be interested to see how that turns out at the end of session.
Okay, let's go to outrageous and or kudos. Wayona, let's begin with you this week.
So I have a kudos. It's been spring break in Rhode Island, and a lot of organizations have had youth leadership summits. So the Secretary of State had a civic leadership summit. Muse Foundation had Turned Up Rhode Island for young people. But my special kudos is the Winner's Circle Mind Blast Hackathon that's taking place this week.
Oh, my goodness.
And
what is that?
What it is middle school students, about 10 middle schools, are participating in using extended reality and virtual reality to solve a social justice problem. So the Economic Progress Institute have paired up with Sophia Academy, and our social justice problem is public transportation. And so they will be presenting on a solution to that social justice problem this Friday. So I'm really excited.
Maybe they'll have the solution for
Rhode Island. I think they do. I think they actually
do. Can you do a little something about better spring weather? Spring break, it still feels like February. Ian, what do you have?
I have a kudos and an outrage. I want to congratulate Raymond Beccari Jr., an occasional panelist on this show. He has a new job as a digital content producer and assignment editor at Channel 12. There's a lot of talent over there, so I'm sure he'll learn a lot. Good for him. The outrage is how the alarming number of deaths and near deaths of young children in Rhode Island. We news organizations regularly get these disclosures from the State Department of Children, Youth, and Families. It's gotten so bad that an advocacy group encompassing more than 40 groups is calling for the state to take action to put more money and support behind policies that will promote better health and awareness for these issues that affect young children. It seems like there's not one single issue that's responsible, but it's an alarming situation, and the good part is that there's more attention about it now from media organizations, so hopefully we'll see some improvement.
Absolutely. William?
I have an outrage related to the school bonds that was a topic on previous episodes, specifically the Bristol Warren School Committee and the Warren Town Council, who really had some explaining to do after it came to light, after the bond passed, that there was pending litigation, and Warren had a significant lawsuit which exceeded our limits with our policy with the interlocal trust, made us drain our rainy day fund and put us on a hook for $1 million for the next 3 years. So the town of Warren is facing a 5% plus property tax increase, which we're going to have to go to the General Assembly to get approval for. And shortly after the election, our town manager skipped office to go work for the Gabe Admiral campaign. Our director of finance took off. And the question of
who's left to turn the lights out?
Well, now come to find out, the bond funding is going to be needed to be included in our budget in fiscal year 26, which was unexpected as well, too. So it's a real mess and a real quagmire in Warren. And it just goes to show that the stuff gets pushed through, and they really should have known about the pending litigation before they supported this bond.
Just briefly, 45 seconds, Kathy Gregg had an article about Senate President Ruggiero has had some health issues. We've all kind of known this, but it's come out. And I wonder what that means for the future of the Senate leadership.
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, Ryan Pearson has been seen as the heir apparent, but the question is whether he stepped in it by encouraging President Ruggiero to leave earlier. The thing to watch is next January when the Senate organizes itself for the next 2 years, and whether Pearson
Think his chair will be in the bathroom or what?
It remains to be seen. I mean, whether he can heal his relationship or whether Ruggiero, assuming he wins re-election, whether he supports someone else as his number two.
It's going to be uncomfortable in the chamber this spring, though, don't you think?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, folks, that is all the time we have. We appreciate your spending your time with us. Billy, good to see you. Wayona and Ian, come back here next week. We are in the heart of the legislative session. If you don't catch us Friday at 7 or Sunday at noon, we archive all of our shows at ripbs.org/lively. You can catch us on social media and take us with you on your podcast wherever you go. Come back next week. We look forward to seeing you as a Lively experiment continues. Have a great weekend.
The Lively Experiment is generously underwritten by...
Hi, I'm John Hazen White, Jr. For over 30 years, A Lively Experiment has provided insight and analysis of the political issues that face Rhode Islanders. I'm a proud supporter of this great program and Rhode Island PBS.